Welcome to the Scottish Watches podcast. We have a returning star guest, star attraction today. Yeah, I mean, he wasn't happy enough running the world of cars. He had to move into the world of watches, launch an equally successful YouTube channel. Not the car guys this time, but the watch guys. And we bumped into him at the London Watch Show. And he twisted our arms up our backs to say, I want back on your podcast. You better make it happen because I know people. So here he is. It's Damien from the Car Guys and the Watch Guys TV. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you, Ricky. And hello, Dave, as well.
Hello, everybody.
Hello, Dave.
Hello, Ricky.
I don't even have to introduce you. He's an absolute successful superstar. He knows to bring on the co-host and drop him in front of everybody.
Fragile goods and all that.
Dave, ready for tomorrow?
Dave is good. Dave has had a relatively productive week, considering it's only Tuesday. So, yeah, not too bad. Popped in to see Simon yesterday for a few things and got a look at a couple of new PCs that are floating around. And hopefully only another week or 10 days or so until my little Doxa 600T Titanium drops, which I'm looking forward to quite a lot. That's a cracking looking little thing for the money. So I'm quite excited about that little one.
That the time and tide?
That indeed is the time
and
tide.
The one we got our knuckles wrapped for?
That's the one that we may have got into trouble for. No idea how.
Because we stuck to the rules and someone didn't tell us about embargoed time zones. And when we say Monday, we mean midnight on Monday, not 8 a.m.
Yeah. Because, you know,
FYI,
GMT, you know, center of the world, all that, you know.
Well, it was BST, but we'll keep quiet about that. Shh. But anyway, we don't care about you. We've got a star attraction here with us. And he didn't stick our arms up our backs. I was kidding on there. We invited him back on the show because it's been far too long. He's been on once before. He's done Scottish Watches Live on our secondary YouTube channel in the past. And we met up nearly 2 years ago in Edinburgh for the first time with Jonathan from the Edinburgh Watch Company when we were over at Mercedes. And you were recording some car stuff that day. If I remember correctly, it was some nippy Mercs.
Yeah, exactly. I was taking out one of those like four-door AMGs, I think, with Jonathan from the Edinburgh Watch Company. So we had a good old day and, of course, saw you guys as well. So it was quite a productive trip up to Scotland.
Yeah, it was good fun. And I think little did we know back then that we wouldn't be seeing each other for nearly 2 years. Crazy days. But no, we were at the London Watch Show, all three of us. And it kind of surprised me just how good it was. And last night I was watching the second season of Grey Market, which is Roman Scharf's YouTube thing, a bit like The Timepiece Gentleman, but not shite and full of lies. And it was really good. And he was talking about coming across to the UK and Ireland, meeting Nico, finding out about Pride and Pinion, showcasing their amazing showroom. I never realised just how good looking that was. It's a converted bank and bank vault. I think it's in a hotel over in Ireland and it is just spectacular. It's like something that Sherlock Holmes, the way they've got it set up with the showrooms. And then they went across in a private jet across to London where we obviously all met up. It was a good old show. What did you think yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I was really impressed with it. I mean, certainly the scale, the fact that they had that venue, the fact they had so many different sort of retailers and companies there, you know, not just watches, but also artwork and some collectibles. So, you know, considering it was the first one, I thought security felt really good. So I felt really safe in the venue itself. And obviously you had loads and loads of different traders, all different types of watch places. And of course, the place was like festooned with YouTube celebrities as well. So I got to sort of meet, you know, certainly well, everyone got to meet Nico, let's face it, because he was in your face everywhere. You couldn't get away from him. But certainly got to meet some of the other YouTube guys from the States, which I'd never sort of seen them before or watched them. But yeah, it was I thought it was really good, actually, for considering how new an event and considering the times that we've just had, it felt pretty meaty an event to me.
You're right, but Nico, he kept running around, headbutting everyone in the knees.
He certainly did. Yeah, did you not get his hand on your shaft at all? No, you didn't get that one?
No, no.
He was doing that.
He was tickling my balance cock, though.
Now that was me, mate.
You must have shaved your hands a little bit from the last time.
What was your, I mean, out of interest, Damien, then at that show, did you go in to the show with that kind of preconception of what it was going to be like from a point of view of it mostly being kind of, you know, grey retailers and kind of pre-owned retailers as opposed to being a kind of brand-led show? Did you already have that kind of preconception?
I'm not really sure I knew exactly what it was going to be. I thought there was going to be maybe a little bit of brand action, but typically brands don't join events on the first one. It takes a while for them to get involved. So I thought it would be lots of eclectic watch dealers, you know, lots of guys guys wearing waistcoats and loud shirts. I thought there'd be definitely a lot of that. I think probably the only thing I was disappointed is that there wasn't as many sort of keynote speakers or entertainers, you know, people up on a stage. I really would have liked a lot more sort of more interesting heavyweight Q&As or sort of discussions in a sort of stage environment. I think that would have really sort of added something, because otherwise it was really just lots of traders. And if you didn't want to sort of go through and fight through the melee of people to get to the glass cases and then try and desperately look at a watch under bad light, you know, being shuffled either side, if you didn't really want to do that all the time, which is mainly what was on offer, it would have been nice to have kicked back a bit and maybe watched some people talk. And, you know, I was hanging around for that, but it never really happened on the first day.
Is that because you read the signs that said Paul Thorpe would be on at half two, and Paul Thorpe didn't know that he was on at half two?
I was literally there just before half two going, where the hell is Paul Thorpe? And then I think literally 45 minutes later, I saw him walking briskly through the event with you, Ricky, next to him. And then I went, oh, he must be about to speak. So I then went over to the sort of area where he was supposed to do, I think it was an hour-long chat and Q&A session. And just as I got there, maybe 5 minutes later, there was a small round of applause and he was off. So I think he totally bottled it.
Well, we did frog march him to the front.
We did.
And I think it's a case of, we've spotted this with other YouTubers, not naming any names, when they're sitting quite comfortable in front of a microphone and a camera and they can record, pause and edit, it's fine. Or if they've got a script, but you put them in front of a live audience and it's a different kettle of fish. Not that we're fantastic at doing it, but we've recorded live podcasts in front of, I think it was a Red Bar, it was a Red Bar event that we did in Glasgow, and there was maybe 50 plus people stood in front of us. Yeah, I think he just got a little bit nervous. Plus, they hadn't told him ahead of time. It was kind of news to him when we first told him, you're supposed to be on stage. He didn't know what it was about. An hour's chat about what exactly?
There was like signs on there that said, you know, Q&A event with Paul Thorpe. There was like signs all over the place.
Exactly, yeah. I think as well, if they were going to do that in the future, I agree with you, having some kind of interactive content, engaging content that's not purely look at this shiny Rolex, you want to buy it. I think that would give more depth to the show, but I think they would probably have to have another room or a side room, because trying to do it in that atmosphere as well, it's quite echoey in the big hall with all the noise. I think, and again, maybe rather than having one poor person dumped on the stage and told to kind of host, which can be quite intimidating, maybe a panel discussion, maybe a kind of curated panel that's got you know, some topic that's been pre-thought out beforehand. I know that when we did the panel discussions at the Red Bar Global in New York in 2019, they worked really well. There was a big audience, but when there's a couple of people either side of you and there's someone that's kind of comparing it and there's someone kind of holding it, it definitely takes the edge off that nervousness and you tend to forget about the audience. I think that would definitely work.
100% yes as well. And you'd get that banter as well that you get between guests. So it makes it a lot more relaxed.
Absolutely.
There was this on the second day when we weren't there, because I've seen the videos where they had all the YouTube guys on stage. I don't know if it was a closing ceremony, but that went really well. And if they had adapted that in the first day, that would have been great. But I mean, got to give credit where credit is due. I've run events, and I've said this before, your first event is always shit. And even our fifth event, 10th event was always kind of shit. And there was always something going wrong. These guys did amazingly well. And if they learn from the small mistakes and the second event is 10%, 20% better than the first one, it will be fantastic. It was sold to the dealers as a business-to-business thing. This was something else I picked up in Roman's video last night when I watched it. Nico was talking about this is a trade show. This is a trade show with retail. So they were expecting it to be between dealers.
Yep, no. Absolutely. You know, like that was one of your first points, Damien, as well. And I agree with you. You know, that kind of show, the one thing they definitely did do well was the security, albeit probably they could have done with thinking through this is going to take a while to get folk in and, you know, having more people or whatever to get those queues down. Luckily, it was a lovely day. So that kind of got them out of jail in that respect. But if that had been a wet, miserable day, it would have been an altogether different experience outside. But, you know, all in all, pretty good place to start, I would suggest. And it was just great to see people in the same room again after near part of 2 years of not being able to do it. So that was good.
The thing is, as good as it is, and I'm pretty crazy when it comes to impulse buying watches, it was not the right environment for me to sort of buy a watch. At no point did I think, oh, well, I'll, you know, I could get close to buying a watch in that environment because it's just completely alien. It was nice to see rare watches. It was nice to see watches that you maybe didn't get to see or can't sort of see. But yeah, in terms of the buying aspect, I think that was probably probably one of the biggest missing parts as well.
There was somebody I was speaking to, and I can't remember who. Long COVID, we'll blame that. That's my go-to at the moment. And they were saying that the environment wasn't the way that people should buy watches, which is kind of true. If you're going to buy a Batman or a Hulk, and you're going to meet Jonathan at Edinburgh Watch Company, you know this better than anybody, you've bought watches from him before. He treats you like you're going into a boutique. You know, it's with kid gloves. You're there, you're the customer. Everything's about you versus if you watch Roman's video and you hear Nico doing his pep talk to his staff, it's like, right, okay, you know, everyone needs to get seen. Do this, do that. Be quick, do this, do that. It was not an auction, but it was like going to a market and quickly rattling through as much. And if someone's going for their first Rolex and they've saved up, they want a little bit of that luxury experience, I suppose, so you're bang on. But Roman's video, really good. Different from all the other London Watch Show videos that I've seen online, which is mainly vloggers walking around covering the event. He covers it from travelling from the States across to Ireland, then from Ireland across to London. Although there was a couple of funny points. And when he ended up at Nico's place, he was in their showroom, and Nico was showing off these massive paintings and murals and things, and he points up at the wall and says, "Do you recognise that guy?" Roman looks up and has no clue who this dude is at all. Nico says, "That's Hans Wilsdorf. Do you not know who that is?" Roman's like, "Nope, no idea at all." So it just goes to show these YouTube guys that are running dealerships, the majority of them are businessmen.
Absolutely.
They're there to get up, go to work, make money, pay the mortgage, whatever it is, and then go home. So it just totally switched things in my head a little bit. A lot of these, like Adrian, like even obviously Nico knows his history and whatnot, and that's how he got into things. But Paul Thorpe has said to me on many occasions, he is a watch dealer first and foremost, and then he learns about the other stuff afterwards. So it was interesting to see that. And one handy hint, Roman and the rest of you American guys, when you come to the UK, you want to be changing your cameras to PAL settings so you don't get that strobing effect with all the lights that run at 50 hertz over here. Just an FYI. But anyway, we're already nearly 15 minutes into the show, and we haven't done the customary wristwatch check. And you're the guest of honour. So Damien, what's on the wrist today?
Okay, well, I've got on today a fairly new purchase for me. So this is the Vacheron Constantin overseas self-winding. So this is that one with the ridiculously sort of translucent blue dial. It's got a date window, and you can basically, it comes with three straps, comes with a bracelet, a crocodile, and a rubber, and you can swap them out using its sort of bracelet technology really easily. So this is one that I'm sort of wearing quite a lot, just because I can easily have it either on bracelet or on the croc. And it's just a really beautiful, simple watch. And it's also my first ever Vacheron Constantin.
What do you think of the new one?
Which one? Are you talking about Everest?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I quite liked it, actually. I didn't think I would. I'm not sure, it's some of those faded sort of ones, you know, more sort of bluey grey ones usually don't do it for me. But actually, I really like the, what is it, the dual time, is it? Is that the one that's...
The GMT dual time.
Yeah, yeah. I actually did quite like that one. Didn't think I would, and it's a bit more of a sort of real modern funky vibe for Vacheron. So actually I could probably quite easily see myself sort of putting that one on my wrist, I reckon.
It's a beautiful watch, and it's definitely one of the classics, and it's one that up until very recently has been one of the vastly overlooked classics, to be honest. You know, it's kind of been in the shadow of the Pateks and of the APs of this world, but you know, can quite easily hold its own. And even though they're now, you definitely have to pay retail price or a little bit more on the grey market to get one these days, whereas only a year ago you could usually pick one up a little under retail if you were clever enough.
And you could actually go in and get one as well. I was told that basically when I bought my one, it just moved to boutique only, and then they binned the waiting list as well. So they even changed the allocation system. So I think the guy was telling me I was pretty lucky to just get in there at the last minute.
Yeah, that's right. I think that was not that long ago, all the blue dialed stuff got made boutique only. And you know, you can see though that Vacheron have definitely got an agenda as to how to, you know, push up the exclusivity, push up the kind of desirability of these watches as well. Quite rightly, in that, you know, they have kind of been in the shadow of other brands.
David, what you got in the wrist?
Oh, well, I'm coming second again, which is always good for me. I have got my Moser on again.
Nice.
Just tends to be a very solid go-to for me these days. It's just such a verging on for me, certainly. Perfect watch.
Yeah, beautiful.
that just hits the nail on the head. Size, everything about it for me is right. I have genuinely not found anything about it to complain about yet in any way, which is rare for me. I'm pretty good at picking. There's always something about everything that annoys me. Even speedies that I love, just there's certain bits about it that niggle me a little bit, but this is just on the nose. So that's what I've had on today. And
Streamliner Green Dragon?
I think its official name is Streamliner Center Seconds. And it's the Fumi Green Dial, which has got various nicknames, the Green Dragon, and I think it's actually called Matrix Green as its official colour. But yeah, actually, ultimately, a very simple watch. It's not a watch also that particularly screams and shouts, so you can generally wear it with a short sleeve without too much fear of people clocking it. It's one of these ones that people, they look and they go, looks like a nice watch, but it looks like a nice, you can see folk, it looks like a nice watch, but I'm not entirely sure what it is, and it doesn't say Rolex, so it could be cheaper, it could be expensive. And usually the way I dress, which is like, is it worth mugging that idiot wearing stupid trainers and jeans? And usually they'll look at me and go, well, if he's wearing that, it probably isn't a good watch, therefore I get allowed to walk on my way, which is very handy. But there we go. Anyway, Ricky, you can be the last part of the threesome.
I'm last on. I'm the dad.
Last on is a dad. What may you have on your wrist today?
I'll play it out for the micro brands. I'll play it out for the little guys this time, since you ballers are here. I have got a brand new watch in from Elshan over at Zelos. And this is the Swordfish 40mm titanium with forged carbon bezel insert and dial.
I saw that, actually. I think I saw it. Was that on your Instagram or something? I've seen that from you.
That yesterday.
I like that.
And it's already sold out. The guy just, he doesn't do enough watches, which is, I suppose, a good position to be in, because you want to sell out so that people have got anticipation for the next one. But these have already appeared on eBay, vastly marked up. So this is a micro brand that plays in the lower price point, but the quality has always been decent. We've seen three of these watches over the last year and a half. And this one is $359, which is around about £260 delivered. And Dave, you saw this one yesterday when you were over. What did you think of it in person?
Do you know, the quality of the manufacture on it is really good. Even like I had a play with the bezel on it. It's nice, it's tight, it's got no play in it. It's got kind of quite a finely graded, that's a burp. It's got quite a finely graded bezel on it as well. So it's not kind of a coarse bezel in any way. The forged carbon parts look really good. It's one of these watches that, in all honesty, if you took it and put certain other people's brand name on it and stuck $2,500 on it and stuck it in a jeweler's window, it would probably sell and nobody would bat an eyelid. And that's where I always find these kind of pieces, you know, whether it's this from Zelos, whether it's, you know, some of the other stuff we see from some of these micro brands at £300, £400, £500, £600. Some of the stuff's genuinely really well made and put together. And yes, it doesn't have the snob factor of made in Switzerland. It might be made in China or Taiwan, or it might be made in Hong Kong or whatever. And it might have a Swiss movement in it. It might not. But that doesn't actually take away from the fact, you know, you don't see folk moaning about Apple iPhones being made in China, but that's where they're made.
It's like China is the new Japan. If you watch Back to the Future 1, and Marty goes back in time and he's like, oh, this is the part that's knackered in the DeLorean. And Doc goes, of course it broke down. It's made in Japan. What do you mean, Doc? All the best stuff's made in Japan. No, it's China, because all your iPhone stuff comes from China. But this is a fantastic watch. I absolutely love it. It was Jody at the Just One More Watch YouTube channel that put me onto these well over a year ago now. And when it arrived, it comes in a nice package box, so it's not going to get damaged in transit. It has got a very thick cardboard sleeve with the details embossed in the front. Inside that, you get a wooden box. Inside the wooden box,
nice,
you get a little travel pouch carry case that is also really quite decent. And inside that,
put your fly back up, Ricky.
That was quite a long fly. I have to get the big monster out. Travel pouch where you can have up to 4 different watches. And one of the best parts about Zelos is the warranty card. Looks like copper.
Oh, nice.
And it's laser cut. So it's a fine mesh warranty card.
It's made with frickin' laser beams.
Frickin' laser beams and sharks. The watch itself, I've only had it for a couple of days, like I said, but already very easy to adjust. It has got screwed links, unlike your cheap Patek green thing that we're going to discuss later on. Also got quick release on the titanium bracelet, solid end links, and the details on it are, it is 40mm, as you'd expect, lugged to lugged, 46, thickness of 12mm, 200 meter water resistant, Sapphire Crystal with inner AR coating. And let's just do that lovely thing that we like to do on the show.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
It's a bit tight because it's new and fresh and Dave hasn't played with it yet.
So
there we go. Wrist checks done. And there was a couple of questions I was going to ask you, Damien, before we got into wrist checks, but Mizzio likes to keep things in a timely manner. You used to work in publishing.
Yeah.
And publishing kind of goes hand in hand with events, because if you've got a magazine, usually there's a tie-in. Did you ever have experience putting on shows yourself?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I set up quite a few, and we did some to do with science, and we did an automotive one. So we did a 9/11 event. And the thing that I found is that they were great fun, absolutely exhausting. And whatever you made basically paid for all the time and effort of all the people to set up the show. And then you basically had nothing at the end of it. So unless you had like this Geiger advertising monster, which a lot of the magazines that I did weren't hugely advertising based, it generally the advertising would be all the profit and you know, to cover the enormous costs. But I never really made a penny, and they were totally knackering. So they were brilliant because you got to sort of meet people and have a lot of fun, but they were never really like a huge part of the business.
Like a beer money type operation for fun.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, you got a lot of fun.
Right, okay. Well, it's time to talk more about watches and things. It's been a couple of years since we saw you, Damien. What have you been up to?
Oh, ice cream truck.
Ice cream, please. Ice cream, please. Yes. I'll have a 99 strawberry and some sprinkles, please.
If you guys are wondering why you haven't heard the ice cream van for some time, I thought the guy had died of COVID. But it turns out he didn't. He had a heart attack.
Oh, my God. Cholesterol like, related.
What could be worse? Oh, it was a heart attack. Oh, that could be worse, yes.
Yep, so he's obviously back in his feet and doing 12-hour shifts again.
Oh, good on him.
So I went out. He appeared out of nowhere about a week ago, 2 weeks ago, and I went out to see what was what, and I said, you've been away for a while. It wasn't a holiday because it's the wrong time of year. Did you get COVID? And he says, no, just a heart attack. Typical Scottish guy.
Good West Coast of Scotland attitude. Don't be silly, son. Oh, it was only a heart attack.
He showed me this thing he got at the hospital. It's like a coffee royalty card where you've got five dots, and he went, if I get another four heart attacks, I get a free heart.
The thing is, you're lame for that. That's the best bit. He's like, I've got one, I'm not wasting the four.
So there we go. Wow. Yeah, that went off on a tangent. So did last show when we were talking about where vanilla came from. Wow, that had a reaction.
Let's not revisit that. Especially when people were starting to, it was even when Adrian was putting up the little quotes when he went down the rabbit hole of Forbes. Where does vanilla come from? Oh,
Damien, did you happen to catch that one?
I did, yeah. Yeah. I was in the car and I almost crashed.
It was the lady's quote from one of the research companies that said, I mean, when smelling beavers' bottoms, they have a very sweet smell to their bottom. You're just like, no.
Right, watches. Damien, what have you been up to in the last couple of years? We know that you got a hold of one of the green guys from Patek, and I know that you weren't super happy about what happened with Antiquorum. Do you want to chip in on your thoughts on that one before we go through the last couple of years and what else you've looked at, seen and bought?
Yeah, I mean, it was unbelievable that I even got offered one of those things. And in fact, I was joking. I was on the call to my local dealer, and we were laughing about how no one is ever going to get one of those watches. And the fact that, you know, Thierry or whatever was, he even joked about how impossible it would be to get when they launched it. And not for a minute did I think that I was going to, even though I'm quite a good sort of Patek client and have a really good relationship, not for one second did I sort of expect to get one. And then just at the end of the chat, we were talking about all the ones that they'd launched in at the same time, all the different models, and they just sort of said, and just to let you know that you've been selected to get one of them. And I mean, I was absolutely flabbergasted. And they sort of said, do you want the one with the diamonds or do you want the one without? And to be honest, when I sort of looked at them, my gut feel was that I would never ever wear the one with diamonds, because I thought it was a bit too bling for me, a bit too Liberace. So I sort of said, oh no, if I was going to get one, it would definitely be the plain one. And then hey presto, they said, yeah, you're definitely going to get one. And I think, because what was even greater about it is that they did the reveal, and I think within a week of the announcement, it was in my hand, you know, so they really got them out. Ooh, quickly.
That is pretty impressive.
You know, I'm really, really pleased for you. But I think for me, above all else, there it is.
There it is. You can't see it because obviously it's so subtle a green that it's literally impossible to tell unless it's in bright sunlight.
In bright sunlight. I think
you know, Mizzio will put some nice pictures and a link to your videos on it in the show notes.
Yeah. Nice.
I think for me, the thing that is telling most about that is, you know, you went in with zero expectation of getting one or being offered one. And I'm guessing you probably didn't even ask because you thought, what's the point? You know, it's not going to happen.
True.
That is, everybody, that is how to treat ADs, and that's how you will generally sometimes, if you're lucky, get things, because they are humans as well and they don't like giving things to people that are pushy and arrogant and arsey with them. If you're just a decent person, treat them with, you know, respect. This is what happens. You will suddenly, out of the blue, get offered something. Usually sometimes when you can't afford it, but hey, that's just the way the cookie crumbles. But you know, that's how these things come about. And I know from me that I tried to treat folk that way as well. And I've been lucky to be offered some Omega, you know, pieces and various things over the time. That's been for no other reason than I've not been an asshole. I can be an asshole, but I generally try to not be an asshole. And that's how these things work. So, you know, really pleased for you. And it's actually gone to someone deserving, which is a great thing.
Well, yeah. And also, I suppose, importantly, and tied into the anti-quorum thing, someone who's not going to flog it immediately just to make that vast return. Because I mean, I thought they would obviously be worth more because then they're only making them, I think, until January or February next year. So it's like less than a year of production. I think people have said that there's only going to be 1,000. I don't know if it's true that there's only going to be 1,000, but it's certainly limited. And obviously, I thought prices definitely would be high, but even I never thought they were going to get as high as that. I mean, we're talking about almost the same price as the 40th anniversary Nautilus, and that's got an inscription on the dial, and it's obviously a historic anniversary. I mean, this thing, as much as I love it, and I think a lot of the love that I've got for it is the fact that I never thought I'd get it. So that's a big part. But it is a slightly olivey 5711. There's nothing else different about it. It doesn't come in a different box. There's no inscription. There's no extra special sort of workmanship in it. It still feels the same. So, I mean, that auction result that we saw at Antiquorum, you know, $490,000, including all the fees, is just ludicrous. And that's probably going to be the most expensive one, I'm sure, ever. But the fact that it even got there was flabbergasting and you know, made me sort of quite worried about the fact that I'd gone out there and said that I've got one, because it's, you know, of all the watches, it's probably the one that everyone wants the most.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think it just shows the absolute lunacy of where we're at this point with watches in general. You know, when a watch that is a lovely watch and is broadly worth its retail price, give or take, and even at that, you know you're paying a fair premium over, you know, someone's making good profit on that at its retail price, but for it to sell for, let's be honest, the best part of $500,000 is just utter lunacy. But hey, it's the world we're in, you know. But it is sad as well, though, that it's probably put you, as you say, slightly on edge. Will you wear it out now? Guardedly, possibly. Will you wear it out anywhere that there's any degree of risk? Probably not. And then that in itself takes the fun out of something that, you know, isn't inexpensive and something you've got, which I think is sad, but there we are.
Yeah, I mean, I'm famous for sort of wearing, no matter what the value or rarity, I wear all of them, and I have worn it, you know, quite a few times. So there is, you know, there is of course a dent or a bang on it, of course, already. It does make you think, particularly London, somewhere like that, it does make you just pause a bit longer than any of the other ones that I've got. Sometimes there's a little bit of fun because if you've got it on and you've got it covered over, you're sort of saying, you know, hee hee hee, you know, no one knows what's on my wrist kind of thing. But in most cases, it's just not worth the risk. So will I stop wearing it? Definitely not. I'll still wear it, and I'll still wear it in a controlled environment or somewhere where I know I'm going to. But that's kind of similar to the cars that I've got. You know, some of the cars I'll only drive if I know what the final destination is, if I know there's a good car park at the other end. So it's kind of a bit like that. But it was amazing to be part of that moment of extreme anticipation, frenzy sort of hype about a watch, and then to actually get it quietly and just sort of, you know, get away with it. I thought, you know, it was special. I think it's part of the reason why it's really special to be part of that whole Patek thing, because if you are a good customer and you work with them well, you can end up getting some quite lovely pieces and you know, most people could only dream of.
Well, I mean, you're a good customer of Patek, but did you not have some bad customer relations with Porsche?
Yeah, to be honest, the Porsche thing was quite funny. I mean, that really got my goat.
Give people a little bit of context, because they might not follow your car stuff as much as your watch stuff.
Well, basically what happened is that I had a fractious moment with the Porsche dealer that I was hoping to be the one that I would deal with, you know, forever. I'd already had one bad experience with a dealer, so I went to this new one and said, look, I've had a bad experience. I'd really like to develop a relationship. And what happened was is that something happened which really got me annoyed, and it wasn't to do with whether I was going to get a new GT3 Porsche allocation, which is what everyone assumed it was about. It was just common customer service. It was all down to the fact that the salesperson that I had been dealing with, and who had therefore built up a rapport and the knowledge of who I am and what sort of cars I liked, left, and no one told me, and the dealer didn't make any effort to contact me and sort of tell me that someone had moved and introduce me to someone else. I had to find out quite a few months later. And really, the whole thing was just about that customer service point, the fact that they just didn't even bother to let me know. And customer service is a massive thing with me in terms of building long-term relationships. So the dealers that I deal with in watches, those relationships have been built over years, and they're, you know, friendly and mutual, and we understand each other, and I you know, they are far more beneficial when they've got your back and you obviously support them. So it was really to do with that. Porsche basically just didn't bother, you know, all my history was just chucked away, and I was kind of left hanging, and it really bothered me. So I unfortunately had to part ways with that dealership, and I've not bought another Porsche since.
Right. So was it just the one dealership that gave you trouble, or was it both of them?
It was, well, both of them. I had one issue with the first one. They sold a car. I was literally buying a car, and then they sold it to someone else whilst I was in the process of buying it. Turned up to pick it up, and it had been sold to someone else. And so that was like one strike. And then I went to another dealer and followed a salesperson that I'd dealt with before. And then we had a customer service issue with them. So, you know, that was them out. I've had a lot of Porsche dealerships reach out to me since, but my worry is, you know, is it really worth it? Is it really worth trying to get, you know, start from zero again and go through that whole relationship? You know, be pretty difficult. So I've sort of like forgotten them for now and pushed them aside.
Well, let's hyping things up a little bit and put a smile back in your face. Now, getting your Nautilus there, mm-hmm. which was unexpected, has that happened with any cars of note? Because you're always doing things, and it could be anything from a vintage whatever through to a Yaris. Has there been any stories where maybe you were looking for something, didn't expect it, and you got something amazing and it just tickled you?
Yeah, well, probably the biggest example of that happening was when Ferrari, so I've had Ferraris over the years, and Ferrari announced that they were going to stop making the 458. So that was the sort of previous two generations of V8 mid-engine supercar. So they said they were going to get rid of it, and I immediately thought, wow, that's such a good car. I don't own one. I need to buy one of those. So I put an order in to get my first ever brand new Ferrari, and something must have happened in terms of the planets aligning. So whether it was the cars that I had in the collection or ones that I've had in the past or whatever, but by buying a new car, it suddenly put a green light for them to offer me one of their sort of super special cars. So that was when I basically said, I'd like to have a 458 Italia. And they rang me back and said, thanks for your order, but would you also like to have a Speciale Aperta, which is the limited edition version of the Speciale, only 499 made, very, very special car, the last ever naturally aspirated Ferrari V8. And then so I kind of went in buying one car and came out with two. But that was the example in the cars where I just never expected to be offered that. And hey presto, it happened. It was just part of Ferrari's mythical car allocation scheme that no one seems to understand.
So you had a cheat code and it worked?
Basically, yeah. Up, down, left, right, XXX.
Well, let's talk about something quickly, because I've got an interest in it. Back in your publishing days, you were the guy that brought Retro Gamer magazine out. What was the story with that? How did that come about? I know a lot of guys that listen to this show are into their vintage computing, retro gaming, because whenever I do a picture on Instagram with a controller or something, I did one recently with a Casio G-Shock and a SNES controller, there was a lot of comments and hustle and bustle. So what was the story with Retro Gamer?
Well, I'm a big, massive retro gaming fan, mainly because I was around in those days. So they are things from my childhood. I've got very fond memories of them all. And obviously that became a big movement amongst sort of slightly older gentlemen, shall we say, who remember the glory days. And so I'd always tried to create retro gaming-y type products in my own portfolio. And I launched a magazine called Games TM, which had a retro section in it. And it also had some sort of lavish pages littered throughout of classic sort of 8-bit games, things like that. So I was always massively into it. Retro Gamer was launched by Live Publishing, probably off the back of the retro section from Games TM. They saw that it could be an idea, and they started a title that was sort of quarterly, bi-monthly, so less frequent. It picked up quite well. It got more popular, and it got to issue 18, and then Live Publishing sadly went bust. As did many sort of companies, publishing companies around that time. We'd been following it in my company. We'd obviously knew the title, and it was one of those things where they went bust. Myself and the finance director immediately went up to see the guy who owned the company and said, that's the one we want. And we actually did a really good, quick deal where we managed to secure the magazine for not much money, plus a load of back issues, which we put into a hire van and drove them down south. And we managed to get it for, quite a small amount of money overall for what I thought it was worth. And then we relaunched it from issue 19 as a more glossy, more stable monthly title, and just poured all of our heart into it. So we brought some of the retro people that we had in my company, we put on it, and we just made it the best possible retro magazine. And obviously no other big publishing company at the time would have even gone near it. It was way too niche for them. There's no chance they would have even gone close to that title. But the passion that we had for that subject meant that we just like poured our hearts into it. And actually it grew and grew and grew, particularly subscriptions. It was a massive title for subscriptions. But the fan base of Retro Gamer is a force to behold. They are really, really active. They get involved. And the magazine itself, I mean, I saw one literally in Smith's, I think it was, a couple of days ago, still going. It still pretty much looks identical to the issue that we put out in 19. So it's still got the same DNA. The layout is the same. They've changed almost nothing.
The corner of it always got me, because magazines would always say new in the corner, but your one, it said old.
Exactly. It's just those little touches that you know, retro gaming people just absolutely love. It's those tiny details that make it and turn it from just being a magazine into something sort of special. And it's still going, and I love it to this day. I think it's a fantastic title.
I think that's telling, isn't it? Like, within print kind of media these days, it's a very tough environment. And you know, either you have to be the big one, the Vogue or the, you know, whatever, or you have to be specialist niche done very well. All the middle ground is the danger territory. That's the ones that just come and go, and the content's rubbish. But it's amazing now when you know, I used to, as a kid, love getting into, you know, what was John Menzies, now W.H. Smith's, and just there was just thousands and thousands and thousands of magazines about everything. And now it is pretty specialist. You know, you look and you find the weirdest and most wonderful subjects that you never thought a magazine would ever be about. But all you need to do is get it right and find that little niche customer base, and they will buy it religiously, as you say.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you remember at the start of the 90s, people used to wear bum bags?
Do remember that, yes.
Right, fanny packs, I think they call them in the States.
Yeah.
So I was a kid and didn't have much pocket money, but I liked computer magazines, so I would go into your W.H. Smith and your John Menzies.
No. I know what you're going to say.
Don't you dare.
What was I going to say?
You rolled it up and stuck it in the bum bag.
No, but I stole the cover discs.
You little tea leaf.
Yeah, I also used to go down to the Barrows Market where they sold all the pirate games and did the same thing.
So hang on, you didn't even buy the pirate game, you robbed the pirate game. Wow, there's a brutal justice there in some form. But
exactly,
you know,
two wrongs make a right. That's the way I was looking at it. Hey, listen, that was back in the days where they were such cheap bastards. They would buy double density 720k discs and use the hole punch to make them high density, because that's how cheap they were. So there we go. There was a walk down memory lane. And obviously we mentioned on a recent show that Sir Clive Sinclair had passed away, and he was like the grandfather of computing in the UK. In the States, it was Commodore 64, TRS-80, those kinds of things. Over here, it was 100% Sinclair and Commodore 64, and there was that bitter playground rivalry. What side did you fall on, Damien?
Well, I was sort of like almost like a double agent, because I started Spectrum, rubber keyed Spectrum 48K, and if I'm being honest, that still got the most treasured memories for me. And then after probably a few years, I did some work experience in a computer shop called the Computer Shack, I think it was, in Bath. And in the storeroom in the back was a Commodore 64, boxed and everything, which they said didn't work. And, you know, I sort of said, can I have it? So they gave it to me. And all I had to do was swap the fuse and it worked again. So then I moved to Commodore 64. And always when I was growing up, a lot of my friends had Commodore 64. So I'd go round to their house to play that, but then I'd go back and play Spectrum. So I kind of did both, actually. And I've got nice memories of both. But if you were going to nail me to a wall and tell me to pledge my allegiance to one of them, it would be the rubber-keyed Spectrum 48K.
Yeah, I was the same. It was like, I can remember, was it ZX80, was that?
Yeah.
Oh, that was the first one.
Yeah. I remember having a ZX80 with the little kind of rubber keys, and then it was a ZX81 that had the clacky keys. I remember both of those, but I was one of those unfortunate children whose father, my dad worked in the Middle East a lot of his life, and, you know, when he was flying back, he would maybe sometimes come through Japan or wherever, and would always come back with the latest and greatest, but he always, always picked the wrong one every time. I remember we were the Betamax family, so we basically couldn't watch any VHSs from anyone.
But so was I.
Because my father liked to tell me that this is what the BBC use and this is the better quality videotape, and the yakety yak. Yeah, that's great, Dad, but I want to watch like some hooky porno that my mate's got at school and I can't. But so that went out the window.
I was at a party when I was about 13 or 14. And there was a copy of a copy of a copy porno tape.
A copy of a copy of a copy.
But unfortunately, the person that had copied it in long play. And my pal, whose party it was, only had a single play VHS deck. So everything was running at twice the speed.
It's more realistic then.
Yeah, exactly.
I was looking at it going, in a couple of years' time, I'm not going to be able to do this.
But then back to the computers. Then I remember he came back from one trip and he said, we've got a new game, we've got a new games machine. And my dad fell for the whole Sony MSX scenario where Sony, Toshiba, Panasonic, Fujitsu, I think, as well. And a few of them all got together and had this MSX platform. And I can remember the graphics on it were amazing. They were genuinely, you know, ahead of quite a lot of the other stuff that was out, but there was just none of the big titles on it. But yeah, I do remember that. So with a Sony MSX, yeah, then I bypassed all of that and went straight to, I think after that, I was actually the original PlayStation was probably the next gaming console I bought myself.
Wow.
Well,
yeah.
I'll follow that story up and say that I had a similar tale. The first computer that I got my hands on was one of my dad's friends in his work, and it was a rubber key Spectrum. And we loaded using whatever tape deck was kicking around, because it wasn't a specific data set that came with the Sinclair. You would just use any mono cheap crap from Argos. And there was a chess game and some other game. And I thought, this is pretty cool. And then it just went away back to wherever it came from. And it was years later that I got what I thought was going to be a Commodore 64. But no, like your dad, Dave, maybe it's the same dad. I get shafted and I got a Commodore Plus 4, which couldn't play any
of the games
whatsoever.
Absolutely.
But it looked space age. It looked really cool. It still looks like a great machine.
The game that actually, though, I've not played it in decades, Manic Miner. That was the game that, you know, I can still, the tune still plays in my head. I played it so much that the tune still goes round in my head to this day. But yeah, I'd love to get a copy of that and play that.
Is that the same guy that did Jet Set Willy?
Yeah.
And he went off the rails.
Yeah,
he had real problems with his health, his mental health. That was a documentary I saw where they managed to get a hold of him. And I can't remember his name, but he's got the same name as somebody that played one of the Doctor Who's, I believe.
Oh, my God.
Smith, maybe?
Was it Matt Smith? Yeah, it might have been. Matt Smith.
And the guys that were doing the documentary had taken him to some seaside place on a pier, and they'd spoken to the owners ahead of time and said, we're wanting to do an interview with this guy, and gave the name, and they thought it was the Doctor Who guy, so they said, that's fine, turn up. And then they turned up with this dude who hadn't been in front of a camera for like 30 years. Wow, this has turned into the retro gaming show, hasn't it? Right, watches.
Back to watches.
What watches in the last maybe year and a half have caught your attention? Have you been looking looking at? Have you liked, disliked, or even sort of bought for yourself?
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, the ones that I sort of, I do have quite an eclectic taste, and so I look at sort of all sorts of things, and lots of stuff comes on my radar. I got quite into Kurono, so I was quite sold on some of those Kurono, you know, that very sort of bespoke Japanese brand. I was very into the sort of anniversary ones that they did. So I recently got the Chrono 2, the Chronograph 2 that they did. Recently, I think I saw on Instagram, I think it was originally, but there's a company called Brew Watches in New York. And they they did this really super cool retro looking thing, which is called the Metric Retro Dial. So if I can, I don't know if you can sort of see.
Yeah, we spoke about that in the show.
Yeah, yep. Amazing. Yeah, I mean, as soon as I saw that and the sort of like little bit of turquoise around and the colours, I just thought that was fantastic. So I got that sort of instantly. There's no.
How much
no
is that one?
Yeah, it's about £300, I think it was. It was, 300 quid.
I think that's, $500, give or take, I think they are US, round about that, neck of the woods.
This is why we like speaking to you. Some people are very, it has to be expensive, but you love everything. We were talking before the show about your Yaris collection.
Yes.
It doesn't matter. As long as it ticks a box somewhere and you like it, you're right into it. So no, the Absolutely. Brew Watches, I think it was Kathleen that was going on about them, saying how good they were when she was on.
He's a genuinely lovely person. He, you know, like, it's an oft overused phrase, but he is actually verging on one of the nicest people in the watch world. He's just such a genuine, nice guy that's got a passion for his thing. You know, it's a bit cheesy, yes, brew, coffee and everything, but he loves coffee as well. He just, he lets his heart go where it is. And you can see that it sings through in some of the designs. It's absolutely fantastic little pieces.
I also got, recently, purely for the colour alone and the fact that it's got a can jar on it, I got this Stella Tiff Blue from, it's a company called Undone. So that's a Chinese-based company. And that's sort of going back to what you said, Dave, in terms of, you know, it doesn't really matter where it is in the world. You know, if you like it, then give it a go. It's never going to sort of like worry, you know, the highest levels of sort of horology. But I just love the colour. I thought it was a brilliant summer watch. I always like those Rolexes that have got, you know, the sort of can jar symbol on them. So, you know, again, straight away saw that impulse buy. And then if I'm going to the other extreme, my Starbucks Submariner finally came in. So that one came in. I've been waiting for that since it was announced. I think, was that, end of last year or October-ish last year, was it?
Yeah, about a year ago, roughly. Right, from now,
September-ish last year,
Yeah, so I finally got that. So that completes my sort of Green Hulk trilogy of Kermit, Hulk, and the Starbucks. And then another one that I really have been looking at for a long time, it's like one of the Pateks that I really wanted, but it's been discontinued. And recently a friend of mine who had it said that he suddenly needed some money. So he said, do you want to buy this watch off me? And it's one that I love, you know, absolutely just so much, but it's the 5726. That's it. So it's got a white, so it's a piano dial, but it's got the moon phase on it. So it's a really sort of classy Patek that you just can't actually buy, you know, anymore since they discontinued it. So you're going there from basically a 300 quid watch all the way up to sort of a Patek. I've tried to sort of calm down a little bit this year in terms of the watch buying, but I've not been that successful, sadly.
Yeah, same here. is there anything that's kind of been on your radar that you've either not managed to acquire yet or is still in the kind of pondering stage? Anything unusual, or have you picked up anything? Obviously, you said your Vacheron, that was your first VC. Anything else from any brands that have kind of popped up that you're considering that you don't currently own?
I'm trying to force myself not to look too widely, but certainly on the radar, I thought that Everest Vacheron was quite interesting. So that definitely sort of piqued my interest recently. It's limited, though, I think, to like 150.
Might
be difficult. Yeah, might be difficult to get. Kurono recently announced one that's called a Seiji or Saiji. I'm not quite sure how you pronounce it, but it's this beautiful turquoise dial with a sort of white strap. That really looked amazing. I was quite interested in the, what's the Omega, the Sedna Gold Omega that they just recently announced, the one with the black dial.
In the Speedmaster.
Yeah, Speedmaster, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, so they launched the two new gold, didn't they? They did the Sedna Gold, I think, with the black dial, and they did the red or rose gold, I think, one as well. They are stunning. We've seen the carny pieces of those, and it is stunning.
Yep.
I'm going to say, because I'm biased, it's not quite as good as the Moonshine Gold one, but it is a beautiful looking watch, and with that dark dial against it, it's very, very good.
Yeah, that was good. And I also, there's two more I had a look at. There was a Gerard Perregaux Absolute Light Bucherer Blue, which was a sort of skeletonized type thing. Really, really like the look of that. Never had one of those before, so I was quite excited. And the last one is one that I can't get at the moment, but hopefully I will, and it's inspired by this podcast again, which was the Studio Underdog Watermelon. I just thought that was so fun, such a cool little thing. I just thought, yeah, that's got to be in the collection. That's just beautiful.
Well, by the time this episode goes out, you might be able to get one. Before the listeners, just to piss all the listeners off.
It's genuinely, it's an absolutely cracking little watch. And again, like we've talked about in this, it is yet another watch that proves you really don't need to spend a lot of money to get something that puts a proper smile on your face. And when you look at it, you think, how the hell can they make this for this little money compared to what you have to pay for other people's, you know? And, you know, he was a great guy to have on. And, you know, I think aside from the watch itself just being cool and putting a smile on your face, you know, it's really nice to see someone young just going, do you know what, screw it, chuck the day job in, get on with it and do something, and apply themselves and have a product out on the market that's selling well. It's good to see that there's still a solid ethic of work out there in some people, which is really good to see.
Yeah, that one really, really excited me. And to be honest, I listened to the podcast and he, you know, he came across so well on it. It was just really interesting to hear exactly how he basically himself took all that from nothing, and it's been a big success. People have took it to his heart. And to me, it takes the collection that I've got is, you know, obviously there's lots of very serious pieces and blue dials and lots of silver and dark and all that sort of stuff. It's just nice also to have like a little sunshine collection that goes with it, of these sort of lovely, bonkers, crazy colours, you know, ones that you can just wear out in a more lighthearted way. So I think it's important for any collection really to just have a few of those pieces sat in there to remind you that watches should be all about fun and not just about sort of, you know, speculation or you know, big brands.
Absolutely. And sadly, you know, most of the big, nearly all the big brands, they'll never ever do things like that because it's too high risk for them. They just don't want to take that risk, which is sad because it does mean you get a very subtly hued palette of colours that you could predictably, you know, write down on a bit of paper if anyone said to you. It would be lovely to see, you know, that's why Rolex did surprise me a little bit by reissuing some of the OPs in the brighter colours. That was a bit of a left field move for sure. I'd just love to see some of the other brands, Patek, just coming out with something in a shockingly bright colour just because. And the thing is, you absolutely know they'd sell every one of them. If Patek dropped a Nautilus with a bright orange or a bright yellow or a bright citrusy colour dial, you know they'd be gone instantly, but they won't do it.
They've done the Aquanaut with the orange a couple of years back, and it flew, absolutely flew, and then they followed up with the Army olive green afterwards. But yeah, look at some of the guys that have done things for the Pink Dial project that you wouldn't have expected to go nuts, and they look fantastic. And then you've got the Doxa range that have come out in all these fancy colours over the last couple of years, and they sell at hotcakes.
Absolutely. There's definitely a demand for that type of thing.
And any watches you've seen that you've instantly went, nope, not for me, what were they thinking of?
I don't know. I don't think there's any that completely jump out at me. I'm trying to think whether anything jumped out recently. I don't think so. I don't think I dwelled on those sort of
Black Panther AP, anything like that?
The Black Panther AP is an easy target. I mean, I wasn't even going to mention that because it's so such a given that no human in the world would ever want that atrocity. I mean, that's an obvious one.
Except they do. Which is the worrying thing.
So you're just playing to that nice guy persona of everything is lovely and you're not going to say any bad things about anything.
No, I mean, give me a few minutes. I'm sure I can come up with something.
Good. Okay. Well, you can have a think about that as we kind of round the show off, because it's been a very quick hour. Before we recorded this, both Damien and Dave got in touch with me to say, what are we going to talk about? Have you got a list of bullet points? Have you got any questions? And I'm like, no, we're just going to see where the road takes us. And speaking of roads, these two Yaris's, what's going on there?
Well, I mean, Jason, my co-host on the carguys.tv, he sort of realized that the Yaris, GR Yaris, was going to be something super special back in February 2020. So before it was really announced, before anything majorly happened, he put his name down for one of them. And I was like, what the hell are you doing trying to, you know, a Yaris? What are you thinking? And he got his arrived at the end of the year. By that time, they'd done the press launches and literally everyone in the world said it was the greatest thing ever, apart from Jeffro Bovingdon, who said it wasn't. But everyone else agreed it was like one of the greatest little pocket rocket, hot hatchy type cars that they've made in the last probably 10 years. And as soon as I drove Jason's, I put my name down to get one. So that's, I've basically been waiting until now for mine to arrive. Essentially, what you've got is a very small car, which has been widened in all directions and made sort of like bulgy and sort of, you know, meaner. It's a homologated rally car. So rather, don't think of it as a Toyota Yaris. Think of it as like one of those short wheelbase Audi Quattros or a Lancia Delta Integrale. It's like, it's that special. It's a tiny short wheelbase car. Yeah, exactly. 6R4 if you want to have a Metro image in your head, which I personally don't. But I mean, you know, it's phenomenal. It's it's four-wheel drive. It's got a small engine, turbocharged. It's got switchable traction. It's got all this tech, all this independent suspension. It's just a little rocket ship.
I've been lucky enough to drive one as well, and it is unbelievable for any brand these days. Never mind one of the Japanese brands. They've effectively used it as a, you know, a development project for their Stillborn World Rally program, and then still threw it out into the marketplace. It's about as perfectly square as you can get a car that's compact. You can spin it on its own length, which is unbelievable for any car these days, and it is just packed with technology. You can throw it at pretty much any part of the scenery and you'll get away with it, which is amazing and scary at the same time. And it's blisteringly quick round corners. I mean, you will get caught in a straight line by something with volume and capacity, but if you go on a country road and you can drive, I dare say there's not much in the road that will catch up with you. You will get away from it no problem at all. Yeah. And it's not cheap, but it's definitely not expensive. It's a proper adult's toy. That's what it is.
Yeah, exactly.
Does this harken back to things like the Glanza turbos and things like that?
I think possibly, like in recent past, things like some of the later generation Mitsubishi Evos or some of the kind of Subaru Imprezas that were fundamentally world rally cars for the road, they were the last generation of car that were maybe in the same vein, but they didn't have anything like the technology or the suspension that this car has. And they were long, they were rectangles. This is a square. This is absolutely a square. It's just so pointy.
Pointy, right, okay.
Yeah.
We've given you enough time to think. Any dogs you want to mention?
No, sadly.
Lassie.
All right, we'll finish the show up saying to you, or asking you the question, what are you waiting for next?
Well, the watch that I'm waiting for to arrive next, I think probably more than anything would be the Corona CG or Saiji. I think that is on its way, or it's going to be arriving in the next few weeks, I think. So that's probably the one that I'm most looking forward to.
Excellent. All righty. Well, it has been an absolute pleasure. As always, it's been far too long since we last had you on. But now that we're able to travel and do things, are you going to be going to any watch events or shows? Are you maybe going to head to Baselworld next year that we might be able to catch up with you there?
I would be trying to get to all of them, I think, because I didn't get a chance to go to them before all the craziness happened. In fact, the year that the craziness happened was when I was due to go. So I'm quite interested to visit as many of those sort of shows as possible, and then at the same time sort of tap into maybe visiting some of the manufacturers at the same, you know, just to, because I've not done that even.
This has got the whiff of a road trip about it.
Exactly.
This has got the whiff of us putting Damien's details on the website as a contributor so he can get press access to things.
Exactly.
We could do a road trip and then do a live podcasting on the journey and then at the place itself. Yeah. We could do this.
Fantastic having you back on the show. It was great meeting you in real life down at the London London Watch Show. And for those very few listeners that don't know where to find your stuff, do you want to give them a heads up?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I've got a small YouTube channel and it's growing steadily, but it's thewatchguys.tv is that on YouTube and on Instagram. And then obviously I've got thecarguys.tv on Instagram and YouTube. So those, you can see a theme emerging there. But the cars I've been doing for quite a few years, but the watches, I basically started the channel when we went into lockdown because it was a lot easier to, I could literally obviously just get a watch out and do an episode without having to leave the house, without having to do external cameras and things. So it was a way really of being able to get through lockdown, and that got me off my arse to actually do the watch channel. So it's been brilliant fun so far. But you can get me, yeah, Watch Guys or Car Guys.
Perfect. There we go. Well, that is the end of our show. We are fast coming up on episode 300. I think this should be episode 298, going by my calculations. Episode 299 is going to be an interesting one. We're not going to tell you what it is, but it is a bit of an exclusive from what I can tell. We have a guest on that has never appeared on another podcast or potentially not on any other channel apart from the one they are known for. And it's somebody that you probably have never seen their face. You might have seen their hands though. So there we go. That is another show in the can. Thank you guys for listening, and we will catch you again soon.
Thank you very much for having me.
Take care.